Welcome to Galactic Chat. My name's Alex, and joining me today is Tahani Wesley. Amongst other things, she has saved the sanity of many people at Australian science fiction conventions over the last couple of years. And when she's not doing that, she's been heavily involved in the Australian independent science fiction publishing scene. She started off in Andromeda Spaceway's In-Flight magazine. She's done some work with 12th Planet Press. And most recently, she's run her own indie press called Fablecroft. Tahani, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So my first question then is, why and how did you get involved in indie press in the first place?
I blame Simon Brown, sure. Who's a Canberra author. Well, he's back in Canberra, I believe. He wrote a book that I really enjoyed, and so I was, you know, doing what you do and looking at all the bits at the beginning and the end, and he mentioned something called The Idolist. And I went and looked all that up on the internet, which was in its early dark ages days, and became part of that online listserv. And as it wasn't very long after that that people, Aurealis came up for sale at one point. This is back in the early 2000s. And people started talking about maybe forming a collective to buy Aurealis and take it on as a group rather than as an individual concern, because that's what kills people, is to try to do things on your own. And then somebody said, and I think it was Simon Haynes, he said, well, why wouldn't we just start our own new magazine? And so I was actually on the ground floor of creating Andromeda Spaceways in Flight magazine, and that's where it all started. So I was part of that group, and I think of it as my apprenticeship in Australian small press, because it really did give me an opportunity to learn the ropes and work with people who knew a lot more than I did, and be able to do it for myself.
So had you been thinking about being involved in editing and or publishing before that, or was it really?
No, probably not really. I have, like, you know, school level editing yearbook stuff was about as much as I'd done before that. Always been a prolific reader and that sort of thing. But no, it had never really occurred to me that you could do something like that. Yeah. And I don't think until I became involved in the Australian, you know, speculative fiction scene and realised how much sort of stuff like that happened and could be done. And, of course, technology's making it a lot easier for us as well. Yeah. I don't think it had ever occurred to me that you could do something like that just as a person, not a company.
So it's just grown up kind of organically as you've become more involved in different aspects of the scene then.
Yeah, definitely. And the more you know and the more people you work with, the more things you can do, and it's fantastic.
Awesome. So that kind of establishes you as, you know, interested and only slightly crazy, getting involved from the start. But starting your own company is quite another thing altogether. So what was the driver behind that?
Well, I've done a little bit of work with Elisa at 12th Planet Press. We did the New Cirrus Nights anthology together, which I really, really enjoyed. And I'd been working with Asm for 7 or 8 years, and I thought that there was projects that were starting to come to me, some ideas I was starting to have that didn't fit with anything that I could do with Asm or with 12th Planet Press. And I just thought, well, there's no real reason that I can't do this on my own, other than, you know, time, money, all that sort of stuff. I decided, well, you know what, I have these ideas, I want to do some things, and it's nice not to have to run them past anybody but yourself. So I just went ahead and did it, and it was a kind of a good time to do it. Fablecroft was formed in early 2010, and were the first two projects were Worlds Next Door and Australis Imaginarium, and they were both out in time for WorldCon in Melbourne in 2010. So it's kind of a, you know, that whole, a really good time to do something like that when there's a lot of creative energy happening in the Australian speculative fiction scene. So yeah, that's where it happened.
So you mentioned the issue of time and money and those sorts of things, and you don't do Fablecroft as a full-time job.
Well, it's probably another full-time job.
It's not your only full-time job.
No, I'm working full-time at the moment, and I have 4 kids as well and a husband, so they're all work. Lots of fun. I'm lucky in that I love my job. I've got a lovely supportive family as well, but I do get probably a little bit less sleep than some people.
Do you feel, does it go in kind of ebbs and flows in terms of when you have to put in a lot of work, or is it really constant with your different projects?
It does have its periods where you're really full on, like at the moment with the Cranky Ladies campaign, and of course, really badly timed, we also closed subs for Insert Title Here, which all need to be read very soon. So it's a really, really busy time, and starting a new job this year as well. That was not really cleverly done. But there's always something going on. You're filling orders, you're doing edits, you're doing proofreading, you're doing marketing. There's always something coming out with the next project, thinking how to pitch it. First time crowdfunding with the Cranky Ladies, and it's just all of these new things all the time. You're always emailing people and talking to people and trying to figure out what's happening next and keeping track of things. So it's fairly constant. There's usually, something to be done every evening.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's hours and hours every evening that need to be put in to make things happen.
So it's a classic small business, really.
It really is. You work all the hours under the moon and sun to make things happen
when you're not at your other job.
Exactly.
So I want to get to Cranky Ladies and Insert Title Here in a moment, but by the time this podcast goes live, you will have had the launch for Fablecroft's first two novels.
Yep.
Which is very exciting. So those novels are Path of Night by Dirk Flintheart and Ink Black Magic by Tansy Rayner Roberts. So I wanted to first ask whether it was different for you to edit and think about promoting the novels as opposed to your anthologies and collections.
It really is different. Editing is a completely different beast with novels, I'm lucky that both Tansy and Dirk turn in fantastic manuscripts. So I've just been working on Joe Anderton's novel as well, which will be out in a couple of months. And they're all fantastic writers. So it's not huge structural editing stuff generally that has to be done, but it is a bit different thing. You're reading short stories, you can sort of do those in bite-sized pieces. You can, read one over lunch and work on it. But when you've got a novel, you really need to have that extended period of time to work on them. And that's been, with the life I lead, a little bit tricky, I found. But it's also a really good experience to do and to see, what changes that, you can suggest that might be able to make that story the best it can be in a novel length work, which is it's a different thing entirely in a lot of ways. But I don't think it's something I'd like to have taken on without having a lot of experience in editing short work before it, because I just don't even know where you would start otherwise. So, it's been a really different thing. It's been funny that both those books, Dirk is a Tasmanian author and so is Tansy, and both of the graphic designers for those books for the covers were also Tasmanian. So we had these publications that were completely Tasmanian created.
Nice.
So that gave us a really interesting sort of niche to try to market towards and things like that as well.
Yep.
The time frame of it has been really strange because they're both released late in the year. They're both now Aurealis shortlisted works, but we're only actually having the official launch for them this weekend. So
fantastic.
It's quite a funny thing, but they've been quite well received, obviously, with Aurealis Award shortlistings for both, and it's just really, it's been a great experience, and I'm looking forward to Dirk's next book.
Yep.
and working with Tansy on ongoing projects as well.
So is Dirk's next book a sequel to Path of Night?
Yes.
Wow.
He's in the process of writing it. I think it's actually nearly at end of draft stage, so that's pretty cool.
The Australian scene, as far as I can tell, has kind of been on Dirk's back for a long time to actually write a novel, so it's kind of exciting to see that we're actually going to get to within a relatively short space of time, given how, well, he hasn't had a huge number of short stories in the recent past, so that's very exciting.
Yeah, he's been doing all these other things instead, like writing operas and stuff.
Yes.
And we still have on the back burner a Red Priest mosaic novel, and also a collection of stories by Dirk Flintheart. So there's some other projects that will happen at some point. He gets sidetracked easily, so this is his baby at the moment.
He's kind of easily bored is my impression.
The
Red Priest stories were the first way that I came across Flintheart's work, so that's very exciting. And that was a long time ago now.
Yeah,
so it's exciting to see to think of that doing something bigger. I have to say, I first read Tanzi's Mottclaw books, Splash That Silver and Liquid Gold, I think just after they were first came out, so that late 90s. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited to see that you were publishing it, because it's just really nice to have the third one. It's kind of part of the trilogy. You can read it by itself. It works really nicely like that. But for the fact that it's actually got proper publication and people can access it, and it kind of, it feels to me like it sort of rounds out the Mottclaw Chronicles really, really nicely. So I'm very excited for that one.
There is pretty cool, and it's such a, you know, it's such a fun book to read as well, which is great. That whole series is, and it's hard to believe that it was 15 years between those books first coming out and the Ink Black Magic making its appearance. So that's pretty amazing stuff. We've still got a few little Mottclaw things to come as well, but nothing set in stone just yet. Just wait, we'll get it to you.
Good. Speaking of Tanzi, she's your co-conspirator on your current project, or one of your current projects, Cranky Ladies. You mentioned it before in terms of the crowdfunding stuff. So what's the go with Cranky Ladies, and where did the title come from?
Well, I dragged Tanzi into that one. I'm not quite sure she really wanted to do it. I think she would have rather written a story, but I thought, no, she'd be the perfect person to co-edit with her historian background.
Yeah.
Cranky Ladies was spawned by a blog post that Liz Barr wrote about a Russian tsarina who really, really bucked the trends of her time, and was, there's images that Liz posted that show her being extremely cranky looking, and she termed her a cranky lady of history, and it just resonated with me so much, so quickly, and I took to Twitter and I said, I linked to the post, and I said, I can think of so many authors straight away that I'd love to see write about their favourite cranky lady of history. And there was all these people going, that's a book I'd love to read. And all these authors going, I'd write that. And I'm like, that's so cool. And so being a small press, you can do things like that on the drop of a hat. So, within a couple of days, we had the idea. We talked about it. As I said, dragged Tanzi into it, and it became this great idea. We had some fantastic interest in it. We called for pitches from authors, because we didn't want people to write on spec and have, you know, several people writing on the same author, on the same person from history, because we didn't think that would, we didn't think it was fair to the authors doing that writing. So we called for people to pitch to us instead, and we had over 50 pitches, which was brilliant, and some absolutely, it was the most fun to read all these things and learn about all these wonderful women who I'd never heard of or had only briefly sort of had knowledge of in passing.
Yeah. So the idea is that they've all taken an historical person, and are they writing historical fiction or speculative fiction or a mixture?
A mixture. That we don't know what they're going to come up with. They've been given a fair bit of free rein.
Yep.
We are quite happy for them to be straight historical stories. Mm. We are quite happy for them to have a dash of the fantastic. And as long as they are firmly grounded in historical fact, and also showcasing their particular historical, their cranky lady. In addition to the pitches that we accepted, and we couldn't choose everybody, because we also invited some, writers who we would love to see write Cranky Ladies. And when we came up with the crowdfunding idea to be able to pay professional rates, we contacted some more authors and were really, really gratified in the response that we got there as well. People were just so positive about the whole thing, the idea, and so many people was like, oh, we'd love to take part, except, so busy, all of those things, because, also, awesome writers tend to be pretty busy. But we've got so much, so many people just suddenly said yes. And it was just, I get these emails in my inbox from these people whose books I absolutely adore. And I've been just blown away. So it's fantastic. So we have this huge lineup of people who are going to try and write for us, and some of them may not be able to due to time constraints and other, life factors.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a really hard job doing the selection for that book, I think.
Oh, that's so fantastic. I'm
glad it's not just me. Tanzi's going to be having to do a fair bit on that.
And you're crowdfunding at the moment in order to pay the professional rates?
Yeah, that's right. And it's been a really interesting interesting ride. I mean, we were lucky in that Elisa at 12 Planet had done the Kaleidoscope campaign last year, so we sort of had an idea of what to expect in terms of the compulsive refreshing of the campaign to see what's going on with it. It's like a sport, a really slow one, as Tandy said. And so we sort of knew what we were in for, and we both, Tansy and I, had gone to some presentations from the possible people to get an idea, and they, you know, to see how what they recommend and what they know works for people, and it gives people the best chance. And so we started to put things together, and we originally were going to go with Kickstarter because now that it's in Australia and it's got such a good international reach. But at the same time, we came across a brand new arts grant from Arts Tasmania called the Crowbar Arts Funding. And basically, they've teamed up with Possible, which is the Australian-based crowdfunding platform. Yeah. And if you meet a few of the little conditions, which we've already met through our campaign, even in 3 days, you're eligible for up to $2,000 worth of extra funding if you meet your campaign target. And so that is amazing. You have to apply for that, and so that sort of stepped up our time frame because we had to be ready 3 weeks earlier than we had thought, but that was good. Gives you a deadline. And so we were their inaugural applicants, so we're the first person to apply for that funding, and we're also the first person to be approved. So if we meet our target, which we're really hoping to do, we're at 43% in 3 days, which is brilliant. Great. 4 days, and then we will receive that extra funding as well, which is a huge, huge bonus for us because it means there's a whole heap of extra stuff we can do for the book itself. So it's brilliant.
Oh, that is fantastic. So the crowdfunding finishes on March 31st.
Approximately. I think it's actually April 1st because we wanted to make sure that international people don't feel like slighted.
So I'll definitely we'll make sure that there's a link to the Possible campaign in the show notes so that people can donate if they so. Well, it's not even really donating, isn't it? It's really
it's a pledge. There's loads of rewards. The rewards start at. There's a $5 one, but there's that's a thank you. We really appreciate those. But there is, every reward level, there's you can get e-books and physical books and chocolate and all sorts of fantastic cool stuff, art prints, and there's even we've got some more rewards that we're going to have to put up because people have absolutely blown us away with their support, and we are already selling out of rewards, so we're kind of like, oh, we will come up with some new ones then if you're very excited about those ones.
Yeah, I noticed that your $500 one went awfully quick.
It was gone on the first afternoon, and Tansy and I were like, oh, okay then.
It's a really exciting response to the campaign. I think it says a lot of really great things both about the Australian scene, probably mostly speculative fiction at this stage, I would have thought, given your and Tansy's connections, but also people's willingness to support it and their interest in what's essentially feminist history.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it's some of those things, I think a lot of people have favourite characters from history, real people from history.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, of course you do. But I think I think a lot of people really like the idea of learning more about women from history because a lot of the times women from history had such a much harder time of things than their male counterparts because they weren't just fighting for whatever they were fighting for. They were fighting against society as well to be able to do the things they wanted to do. And I think that that's what really appeals to people is this, the passion that has to be there and the tenacity and, the general all around, I'm just going to go and do this whether anybody else likes it or not.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that appeals to people about the Cranky Ladies. And much as some of our international counterparts are sort of a bit, oh, why would you call them cranky? It's a very Australian thing,
Yeah, absolutely. That's very exciting. And while that's going on, you've also just closed submissions for another anthology called Insert Title Here. And every time I see that, I'm like, did she draft that? And then forget to, no, that's the title.
And that's Jonathan's... It's Jonathan Strahan's fault because Jonathan was nominated for a whole heap of Aurealis Awards last year and he couldn't attend the awards, unfortunately, but he had his speech delivered by somebody else, and because he was up for several awards in the same category, he wasn't sure if a book was going to win, which one it might be. And so in his speech he wrote, you know, insert thank title, you for the award for, please insert title here. And, of course, his the person receiving it made a joke and just decided to say that. So, and I just thought that's just a brilliant name for an unthemed anthology. So yes, that's what I've called it, with Jonathan's blessing.
So. So when you say unthemed anthology, what did you put in the specs when you asked for submissions?
Basically that. It's an unthemed anthology of speculative work. So as long as it has a speculative element, it doesn't matter what form it takes. So it can be fantasy, horror, science fiction, any of the subgenres associated therewith, steampunk or yep, magic realism or anything. I don't care. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what people come up with. I've had about 250 submissions, I think. Because the guidelines are 2,000 to 12,000 words, some of those are quite long, so I'm looking forward to reading them. Though I do enjoy, I love being the first person to read a submission and know that this one is going to blow people away. So it's great.
In anthologies, there's often a bit of tension when looking at, you know, a year's range of anthologies, either between that theme is way too specific and how can you get enough good stories for that opposed to, as you say, the unthemed thing. So do you feel like you're going to get, I was going to say better, but that's a silly way of putting it. Why unthemed, I guess?
I haven't done an unthemed anthology as such. World's Next Door was essentially unthemed, but because it was for 9 to 13-year-olds, that did kind of restrict it a little.
Yeah.
At the same time, we had stories of all types in there. And I like to think that all the anthologies I've done have been a very loose theme. One small step. I'll try to make it clear in the guidelines. I'm not looking for the theme to be overt necessarily. It can be really ephemeral, it can be really metaphorical, or it can be, you know, it can be right there in your face and that's what it's about. So After the Rain and One Small Step, particularly an epilogue, I suppose, which was originally called Apocalypse Hope, which is actually, I think that probably did it no favours being called Apocalypse Hope, because I think some stories tried too hard for that ending there, and the epilogue became a much more appropriate title for the anthology. I've not done one that is really so overtly unthemed. It's really is, you send me what you think I'm going to like to read. And I don't mind, and I think it'll be interesting to see what sort of mix that makes. It's really amazing though when you put together an anthology, and I don't know if it's because of the, you know, when you start reading, you start to see the connections or what it works out to be. But there generally seems to be an underlying link between stories, and it won't be overt in this one particularly. But it's always there. Like you can, that's what brings it together, is that link between them in whatever way it might be. And some, you know, I don't know what this one's going to be because I haven't started the reading yet. don't tell anybody. By the time this goes to air, I'll have read all those stories. No, I won't. But
yes.
I'll start.
That's a challenge right there.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to read 250 stories by the time this one goes to air. But I will have started, and it's going to be a really interesting exercise because it's not something that I've done before. Although, I suppose I used to read Slash for Andromeda Spaceways, and that was also completely unthemed. I've had a bit of experience.
What sort of a timeline do you have for insert title here? When can we expect it to come out?
I think I've got it slated to be out by Conflux in October.
Right.
So we're sort of looking at, I really want to have the Slush reading done by the end of this month.
Yep.
Although having Cranky Ladies happening at the same time, so it might not be till a little bit later. But I don't like to have the authors having to wait too long for their stories to know what the fate of their stories is either. So yep. I'm hoping to get that organised. So we're sort of aiming to be out in October, I'm hoping. It has to be. There's no choice. Like deadlines. Deadlines are good.
Deadlines are good. And when are you expecting Cranky Ladies to come out?
Cranky Ladies is due in February 2015.
Right.
So we've got a fairly long timeline on that because we wanted to make sure once the crowdfunding campaign had happened, we need to know whether we are able to pay pro rates or not before we can figure out what's happening with the stories. And, yeah, we're looking at then having stories in the second half of the year, editing and getting them off into print by February, although a lot of the rewards will be certainly out before then because we have one of our special rewards is a calendar for 2015, so obviously that one's going to be posted out to people before the calendar year turns over.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other e-books and books that are already existing that will be going out to people who pledge at that reward level well before the Very book is out. Nice. So.
And I meant to ask before, what do you mean by pro rates and why does it matter?
Okay. Professional rates is so something like the Science Fiction Writers of America have a schedule of rates where they suggest that anyone writing at a professional level should be being paid at that rate, which has always been our goal, but it's usually out of reach for particularly small press to be able to pay. We're looking at between 5 and 7 cents a word. Writers are brilliant and a lot of people who are really fantastic writers will write for small presses at a lot less than where, you know, the professional rate, but they deserve more. So we really want to be able to pay more. And this is one way to be able to do that. So that's the main reason we decided to go with the crowdfunding campaign in order to be able to pay people what they're worth.
Cool.
And our artists as well, because the wonderful Kathleen Jennings has agreed to be our cover artist and internal artist, should we be able to pay for internal art.
Excellent.
And, of course, we want to be able to pay her at the rate she deserves.
Yeah. That's very cool. So you mentioned that Dirk Flintheart is working on another novel. Aside from that, what sort of other plans do you have for domination of the science fiction and fantasy scene in Australia?
The very awesome Jo Anderton has her final Veiled Worlds book coming out with us this year, which should be out in the next couple of months.
Cool.
If I haven't broken her with edits. we published Jo's very awesome Bone Chime song, a collection last year, which is so excited. Yep. Shortlisted for an Aurealis Award, as are the two original stories in the book, which is just brilliant.
Nice.
And it's a no-brainer. I love working with Jo. She's in several of our anthologies as well, and she's a fantastic writer. So I'm absolutely delighted to be able to publish this book, which I've loved the series, and to have it come my way as an opportunity is just amazing. So I'm really stoked about that. I've officially no other projects at this stage, but that changes at the drop of a hat. I've got, as I said, Tansy and I are working on a few things. Nothing that we've announced yet, but just little things. They're not huge, but they're going to be fun. So that stuff's all happening. And I'm looking also to continue to expand our ebook range, which has been. We were putting all our new originals out in ebooks as well, but we've done some reprint ebooks. So we did the Canterbury 2100 anthology, which was edited by Dirk for Agog a few years ago, and it was always one of my favourite anthologies. And I wanted to make sure that other people could get it as well because Kat sold out of it for the Agog many years ago, and so I was lucky enough to be able to secure permission from all the authors and the editor and Agog to republish that one.
Marvelous.
And also, of course, Tansy's first two Mocklaw novels we've put out in ebook, and Glenda Lark's Isles of Glory trilogy in ebook as well, which had never been available in electronic form before. So that's pretty cool because I love Glenda's work as well. So I'm really lucky I get to work with people who I absolutely adore reading. So that's really great when you're an editor. And so I'm looking to expand that. I have contacted one author just recently to ask if I could have a look at one of the books that they published a few years ago that was pretty well received at the time but hasn't had an electronic release.
Right.
And so just sort of things like that. Not anything official, not a call for submissions or anything like that. just keeping my eye out and things that interest me. Being a small boutique press, I'm allowed to do things like that. So that's pretty fun.
Yeah. it's fascinating that those sorts of books, some of which have been out for 15 years, are both, I mean, it makes sense that the ones that were put out so long ago haven't had ebook releases, but it kind of fascinates me in a way to think that there is a market for them in ebook format. I guess I'd never really thought about that kind of opportunity.
It depends on the book, I think. Some books don't date well.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Suck Fairies visitors. Yeah. But, like, books, people like Glenda, I mean, Glenda's Isles of Glory books could be brand new on bookshelves today.
Right.
They are just marvellous. And it's, given that Glenda has her own fan base as well, there's people out there who have been able to read her more recent books internationally or in ebook form that would love to, you know, and they have proven to love that the fact that they can now access those earlier novels as well. So it's a lot of authors are doing it themselves. They are self-publishing their back catalog, and that's great too, but sometimes it's nice having someone do the hard yards for you.
Fair enough. That's all very exciting. So having talked about all of those sorts of things, then would you recommend to somebody else that they get involved with small press or consider opening their own?
If they're crazy,
sure.
If they like being broke, it really does depend. I mean, if you're passionate about something and you think that you know a way that you can create marvelous art, then you absolutely should, because people, there's not enough of it. You know, people aren't willing to take the risks, and there are risks. There's, you know, there's a lot of expenses involved. People, you know, it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, well, I can just do this, you know, make this ebook myself, and but it'll do all these things. And it's easy to fall into the trap of forgetting there's a lot of other expenses involved in creating a great book. So it is a little bit, it's expensive, it's time consuming, and it's something that you're always doing, whether you're at your real job or you're hanging out with your family or you're reading a novel or whatever it is. There's always, you know, something will come up and go, oh, wow, that's a really great idea. I should, do that for the press.
Ask if you can help me with that.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing thing. And lots of people start up and have great ideas and can't sustain them, and that's often just basically a real life issue.
Yes.
You know, real life has this horrible tendency of getting in the way. But if you can maintain it, and some people go on hiatus and come back and be refreshed and be able to do more and bigger and better, and it's really, really great, because it's you know, it's a really rewarding thing when you grow these little books into something that's really awesome. And, you know, and for me, it's not about, you know, I'd love Fablecroft to be a going concern. I'd love Fablecroft to be something that I can, you know, say, okay, well, I don't need to work full-time anymore. I'm going to be able to earn an income from this.
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's a sustainable or feasible idea. And it sounds really stupid to say, and people go, oh, that's ridiculous. But I really do love supporting the idea that I'm helping authors to become what they want to become as well.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You know, it's always been part of Fablecroft's charter to do that. It started out as in ASM. It was one of our, you know, driving goals, is that we wanted to support new writers, and I've carried that through to Fablecroft, because there's often not that many markets for new writers, and there's some brilliant ones. I mean,
yeah.
I published Thoreau Dyer's first story. I published Faith Mudge's first story.
Really?
And, you know, these people are just astonishing writers. I published some of Joe's early work. Authors who have, since in the intervening sort of 12 years, been, had book deals with Harper Voyager or Angry Robot or other, you know, major publishers and small press publishers as well. A lot of them had early work in ASM. Some of them have had early work in Fablecroft books or 12 Planet books. And that's a really cool thing for me. And, you know, much as I'd love to make money out of the publishing industry, I'm a realist and I know that that's not necessarily going to happen.
Yeah.
But if I can make it self-sustaining, even that, you know, it would be great, because it means that I could still create great books and be able to read those awesome stories before anybody else does, which is always. So, yes, I would, if people have the energy and the time and are willing to make the investment in this sort of thing and not expect a huge return, absolutely. go ahead and do it, because it's really rewarding in lots of ways. It can be really depressing sometimes as well, but it's really rewarding.
Alternatively, you can just go and buy all of Fablecraft's books, and we'll have a link to Fablecraft so that you can see what sort of awesome books they have available.
Thanks, Alex.
It's my pleasure. Tahani, thank you so much for talking, and thank you for the books that you have created and will be creating over the coming year, because I'm very excited to see them and to see the range of people that you get in your different anthologies. So thank you very much for putting them out, and thank you for chatting to me.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.